All right, I am logging on. Kate, can you hear me?
Wait, no, you keep freezing.
What about now?
Yes, Kate. I can hear you now.
Awesome. Okay. Well, also we're recording from our closet.
It's kind of fun. I feel like I'm at summer camp or something.
This is our recording studio. I'm Ashley Arnold.
And I'm Kate Schwartz.
And this is Together We Move, a monthly podcast about important issues all told through the lens of, you guessed it, running. Today we're talking about running and community in a time when isolation and division are woven into our daily lives. And it turns out that social connection has way more impact on our physical and mental health than people give it credit for. When it comes to building community and living healthy lives, how much of an impact can running have? Could running change everything? Today, we bring you a show in three parts. For part one, we talk to a runner who is looking for ways to expand the running community to make it more inclusive for everyone. For part two, we talk to Dr. Julianne Holt Lundstad, a professor of psychology and neuroscience, about how social relationships impact our health. And in part three, we learn about an often excluded group of people who created their own endurance team that now feels like family. So we're going to start with an interview that you had, Kate, right?
Yes. So I talked with Mike Moreau, who works for Fleet Feet Chicago.
My name is Mike Moreau. I work for Fleet Feet here in Chicago, mostly at the Lakeview and Old Town stores. I also coach high school cross country, track, and freshman boys basketball at North Shore Country Day.
I came across Mike as I was reading a Runner's World article called 11 Black Indigenous People of Color Speak Out About Running and Race. In his photo, he was wearing a Fleet Feet jersey, and we were looking for more people to have these conversations with. So I thought, ooh, a Fleet Feet guy, we have to talk to him. And so as I started digging, I discovered that he had recently started a podcast where he interviews other BIPOC runners to learn about them and tell their stories. And by the way, BIPOC is a term that we use a few times during this podcast, and BIPOC stands for Black Indigenous People of Color. It's a term you're going to hear a lot.
And we'll also link to his podcast in our show notes.
It's been really fun so far, honestly, just because I'm learning more about just people and BIPOC runners in general. I'm also pretty guilty of, in general, just kind of, you know, following the white runners and not really following, you know, other minority runners in the sport or even just the minority casual runners, because I didn't know many were out there. Even though I don't know necessarily a lot of these people, we have some shared experiences, and I think it's really cool because running in general can bring people together because you share similar experiences regardless of the pace you run.
We need diverse groups of people getting together so that people from all walks of life feel welcome and feel included.
And then as a whole, we feel more connected, we feel less lonely, more empathetic and compassionate.
Exactly. But like, just diversifying something isn't going to solve all the problems. For example, Mike even commented that he's been guilty of saying that running is this great sport because all you need is a pair of shoes, but that is really oversimplifying it.
We need to show everyone out there and just make people feel more welcome. And I think the sport can be better because of it.
So how do you think that location and access maybe comes into play here?
That's a great question, and one that Mike actually explored a lot in his most recent podcast, and we talked about it.
On the last episode I did with Carolyn Sue, the creator of Diverse We Run, She talked about on her diversity run panel, the trail runner, I can't remember her name right now, tried to get her friends to, you know, her Black friends to run in the tree, you know, the, you know, trails with her. And she didn't even think about like how nervous that would make them feel about being in a place they're not familiar with. And there's a lot we can work on just by, like you said, wanting to make sure that people feel like they're welcomed. And the more we can do that and feel like people have a safe space, the more that people will become a part of things. Accessibility can be an issue, just getting from one place to another, getting involved with, you know, BIPOC runners at younger ages to let them know that, hey, this is something you can do just to, in general, just for a little bit of exercise. And maybe it's something that they stick with, you know, for a lifetime. And then again, just other runners in general, making an effort to run in different neighborhoods and see different parts of their cities and make people not feel like outcasts, because I think that's a big issue.
And something else that he said was really interesting. He talked about this idea that BIPOC runners outrunning in other communities where white people may not be used to seeing someone of color might, in a sense, help them get accustomed to seeing someone that doesn't look like them. And that would maybe alleviate racism somewhat, create more of what should be the reality that running is truly for everyone.
She's not saying that that will be the answer, but she hopes that, you know, people seeing more BIPOC runners being a part of the community will not make it strange when they see, you know, a BIPOC runner running in their neighborhood that they may not see before and think they're actually just going for a run instead of that strange person in a neighborhood that makes them feel unsafe.
This is a really interesting point that he's bringing up here, because in part two, when we talked to the psychologist, we talked about these casual interactions with people and what happens with microaggressions and just how those casual interactions can really lead to loneliness.
You know, in my conversations with Mike, that was a big topic. And I think that loneliness absolutely comes into play here. So that made me think about this episode of Mike's podcast with a runner named Carolyn Sue. She talks about feeling this pressure to convince people that racism and discrimination are real, as though they don't believe it. And so the two of them were both featured in that Runner's World article that I mentioned, where I saw Mike in the first place. And it's on that topic about racism and discrimination in the running world. So the article discusses all these different experiences that these runners have had. And at the bottom of the article, there were a lot of comments. There were some positive comments, but there were also a lot of negative comments. And some of them were things like, as a white man, I feel discriminated against and picked on by this article. And it was just this really grave misrepresentation of the point that the article was trying to make. It was just trying to foster a sense of inclusiveness by talking openly about these issues.
Oh, so it sort of sounds like this guy or these people making the comments were really twisting it to make it about themselves.
Exactly. And here's what Mike said.
It's very frustrating just because the majority being uncomfortable. And when people are uncomfortable in general, they don't really like it. Like, that guy is probably just so used to things being the same way that when someone brings something different to the table, he didn't like it. And no one was picking on him. You know, we were all just sharing our own stories, and he inserted himself into the conversation when no one really asked him to. No one was saying, hey, you random commenter, this is all your fault. He just wanted to share our stories and have an impact on the running world in whatever way we could. And, you know, getting back to some of the things that running has taught me, it's that being uncomfortable is okay, and it's where you see the most growth. And I think that's what this quarantine has been, that's why this quarantine also has been tough on people, is that a lot of it has been uncomfortable, and we have to have conversations that a lot of people don't want to have, but a lot of minorities have on honestly a daily basis, and they share those experiences constantly. And when guys like, you know, people like him comment, it's just him being uncomfortable. And if he's willing to learn and grow from it, then good. But if he's not gonna want to learn, then he's part of the problem.
Okay. My name is Julianne Holt-Lundstad, and I am a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University. My work, my research focuses on relationships, so social relationships, and their impact on our health, and in particular, physical health. And so this work has, of course, led me into looking at social isolation and loneliness, but conversely, also looks at the protective effects of being socially connected as well.
So essentially, when Julianne started her research, like, no one was doing much with loneliness. There were only 5 studies published in 1988. So as new research started to bubble up to the surface, she began gathering evidence from all over the world to really connect the dots. And she began looking at all of the different ways that people are connected. And she found that those with a high level of social connection had a 50% increased rate of survival. But people didn't really believe her right away.
I mean, I can see why. Really? 50%? That seems incredibly high.
Yeah, it sounds like so much. But in order to prove it, she took the study a step further.
And so really what I did was, because, you know, as you know, the impact of this on our health, our physical health, and even how long we live is not very well recognized by the general public and or even, you know, the medical community. But there are decades of epidemiological research where large scale studies have followed people, you know, in some cases, thousands of people over years and often decades, to see to what extent are people socially connected or conversely, you know, isolated or lonely? And does this predict how long people live? Because, you know, of course, this was so unrecognized, we benchmarked it relative to other factors that people take very seriously. So things like smoking, alcohol consumption, obesity, physical inactivity. And what we found was that this was comparable and in many cases exceeded the magnitude of risk associated with these other factors. So then I did another one looking specifically at isolation and loneliness. This time we had data from over 3.4 million people worldwide. And again, we found a significant effect. So isolation, loneliness, and living alone were each independent risk factors for premature mortality.
So I wonder how the types of relationships you have make a difference. Honestly, most of the strong relationships I've built as an adult have been through running.
Yeah, same. Totally. That is where my mind went as soon as she mentioned relationships too. And it's so much more complex than I even originally imagined. So here's what Julianne had to say.
Of course, relationships are complex. And so understandably, of course, researchers have studied this in a variety of ways. And so one of the things that we did in that big meta-analysis was try to organize to see whether some were more predictive of risk than others, right? And so generally, we were able to categorize these in 3 different ways. And one was when they look at the the structure of our relationships or networks. So this would get at like the size of your network or how many people you have contact with or how frequently you have contact with them, whether or not you live alone. So really kind of numbers based, right? And so, but they really just get at the presence or absence of others in your life, right? and they may not get at how meaningful those relationships are or whatnot. And so the next one gets more at the functions that our relationships serve. And so some of them look at the extent to which there's social support, whether it's perceived or received, you know, the extent to which you have someone you can turn to for favor, for understanding, for advice. So that these functions that our relationships serve.
We really lean on one another for advice, for grounding, for reality checks, for like just acceptance. I mean, I feel like that is what we do when we're out running together. And it's so interesting to me because I think about how like oftentimes without running, many of us probably would never have crossed paths. And now we're really close friends.
Right. And with running friends, there's a tendency to really connect. I mean, we're not distracted by technology or anything else when we're running. And honestly, that's kind of unique these days. Plus, when we run with others, we're conquering a challenge together. I mean, do you think those feelings help us connect on a deeper level?
Yeah, I absolutely do. And I think that you really nailed it on the head when you said we're free of distractions and we're like conquering this thing together. And there's a lot of power in that, like going through adversity with someone else. So when I talked to Julianne a little bit more about this, she also talked about the quality of relationships and loneliness and the roles that various relationships serve in our lives.
And then finally, the last third category gets at the quality. So the positive and negative aspects of our relationships. So how satisfied you are in your relationship or how much conflict or strain there is in the relationship. So interestingly, they all predict health outcomes. and so not only do the close, intimate, positive, meaningful relationships are really important, but there's also evidence to suggest that these kind of even casual interactions that we have, you know, saying hello to someone when you pass on the street or to the person who's bagging your groceries or whatever, that even those little moments of social connection can be beneficial. Having a diversity of relationships may be particularly strong because different kinds of relationships might fulfill different kinds of needs that we have. And so we shouldn't discount these, but we should recognize, however, that negativity in relationships has been associated with risk. So not all relationships are positive. and that negativity can be not only associated with stress, but detrimental physical health outcomes.
So this part really got me thinking about marginalized people like the BIPOC community and how maybe loneliness is an even bigger obstacle for them because of microaggressions. This is kind of the thing that we touched on earlier when you were interviewing Mike. You know, maybe someone is less likely to say hello to someone of color on the street running by or smile to them when they run because of some sort of racial bias. And what if over time that develops into a pattern of loneliness? And if so, does that make it harder to be included or to feel included? So I asked Julianne about that. She said it might be true. And here's why.
There is some research to suggest that those who are members of marginalized or stigmatized groups are at increased risk for social isolation and loneliness. And so that doesn't necessarily mean that they always are or are not. So we can't just assume that anyone is or is not isolated or lonely, but that does increase one's risk. And so, you know, you point to one potential source for that, right? And so that's another point to always be conscious of is you know the mechanisms behind these and how we can act to disrupt these kinds of cycles.
And then also, naturally, I asked her if she thought that running could potentially be an avenue to build community.
And?
Well, and she says, yes. She doesn't run. It sounds like her husband is a prolific runner, though. He's done several marathons, Ironmans, and so she's been at these events supporting him. And she's also a really avid hiker.
I've been at these events and I've seen firsthand the amount of support that is required, right? And so while my research doesn't focus specifically on runners, I have personally seen firsthand how there can be this sense of community around that. And there is some research to suggest, even outside of big events like that, that even just a walking or running or any exercise program, that having someone to do it with, people are more likely to stick with it. Having that support. So knowing that person's counting on you to meet at 6 a.m., you're more likely to get out there and show up so that for that person who's depending on you, so you're more likely to stick with it. And so, of course, that in turn is linked to better outcomes also.
My big takeaway from that is that she says someone else to do it with. And I do think that running with others reinforces the idea that you can count on those friends. It makes me think of some of the conversations I had with the Achilles athletes, but we'll get to that later.
Okay, so one other thing here that I think might sort of tie in is this idea of negative bias.
So one of the things that is characteristic of individuals with chronic levels of loneliness is a negative cognitive bias or repetitive negative thinking. And so in what this means is that in very ambiguous social situations, there's a tendency to perhaps assume negative intent.
So Julian gave me this example of if you text your friend and they don't respond right away, your response could be, oh, they're busy. Maybe they're making dinner. They're with their family. Or you could think, oh, that person's ignoring me. And if you think they're ignoring you and you take it a step further and you actually text them and say, are you ignoring me? Then you've created this really defensive situation. And that sort of energy can spread. So then you put your friend in this awkward situation where they have to react to that versus assuming goodwill, I guess you could say, on the other person. So we talked a lot about that idea of that negative feedback loop that happens. And then she took it a step further to talk about some emerging research in gratitude.
So researchers are looking at empathizing with the other. Can that help disrupt and start to lessen this repetitive negative thinking? Can we decrease that in a way to interrupt that cycle? Another strategy has been around gratitude and how by expressing gratitude to someone, telling them something that you really, hey, I just wanted to reach out and let you know, I really loved this interview. Thank you so much for considering me. You are an amazing interviewer. all of these sorts of things that will elicit, of course, more of a positive response in return, right? And so we can, by expressing gratitude to those, our relationships, that strengthens that relationships, creates a greater sense of social connection and creates an upward spiral instead of a downward spiral and can reduce loneliness. And so these are some ways that we're trying to find to disrupt these kinds of cycles.
Gratitude is definitely having its moment in the sun, and for good reason.
Kate, I'm going to use this opportunity to tell you that I'm grateful for you. Aww. And for this podcast recording that we're doing in this closet right now.
That's really sweet. I'm grateful for this closet. And you, of course.
So we went on to talk more about COVID-19 and its effect on loneliness and things like that. Really tangential to today's conversation, but really interesting stuff. But I also found it quite relevant to our next conversation and to the conversation that you and Mike had, Kate. So here's what she said.
Now the challenge is, what can we do, right, to help reduce the health burden of this and reduce risk? And so thinking about this from not only just individual-based intervention programs, but public health policy. How do we address this more on a population level? Every aspect of our life is influenced by, there's a social component. And what we do can have an effect for good or bad. So these policies that we are implementing can potentially either reduce or increase risk. And so I'm really excited about the future, because this is an important turning point. And I hope that we can take this turning point in a positive direction and be much more consciously aware of and socially aware.
So now we move on into the final piece of this podcast puzzle. And this is all from a series of interviews that Kate conducted throughout the summer. And just so you all know, you can find stories about all of the folks she's about to talk to on our blog on fleetfeet.com/journal.
For part three, we learn about an often excluded group of people that created their own endurance team that now feels like a family. So I actually got to interview, I think, 5 different Achilles international athletes, and I wish I could include all of these here because the conversations were really interesting. But let's start today with a conversation I had with a woman named Lupita, who started her own chapter of Achilles where she lives in Tucson, Arizona. Lupita is blind, and when she was growing up, she got left out of sports. So when she got older, she was determined that she was going to participate. And not only that, but to also help other people get involved as well.
My name is Lupita Hernandez. I live in Tucson, Arizona. I was actually born in Globe, Arizona, and moved down here when I was 2. To go to the school for the deaf and blind. And then I went in 7th grade to public school and on to college. And I've been a teacher for the visually impaired. And that's a little bit about me. As a child, I remember really clearly that we always talk in one of the organizations that I'm in the Federation of the Blind, that about raising expectations. And I was a product in middle school of lowered expectations. And so I would have adaptive PE, and in adaptive PE, we had maybe something like 20 sit-ups and just a couple little exercises. And I remember being left out of sports as a child and saying, I wish I could do the things that the other kids were doing. And I would listen to them playing ball and football and all these other sports that I wasn't able to participate in. So I vowed to be in sports when I got older.
I asked Lupita about what motivated her to start her own chapter of Achilles. And she told me that she was already sold on the idea. And then she went to a conference for the Federation of the Blind in Las Vegas. And she ended up running with a guide there who volunteers at his local Achilles chapter.
I remember so clearly that running. I was going to run just around the block a little bit. And I ended up doing a 5K that day with my guide that I was paired with. And I asked him, why do you want to be in Achilles? Why do you like Achilles? And I really remember that he said, well, I was in it for reasons to try to help the community and help others. But then I started realizing that I was doing it for selfish reasons, because I was enjoying making friends. And my friends were people that I hung out with and I wanted to spend time with. And so after that, I decided that I just love doing it for fun. And I thought, wow, I really want to bring this to Tucson. I'm kind of jealous that there's an Achilles in Las Vegas. I want to bring that to Tucson. So he said, well, after we run, I'll get you in touch with the right people to see if you can get an Achilles started in Tucson. Tucson. I think going back to the fact that as younger, I was left out in sports. I didn't want anybody else to feel left out in sports. And so I would talk to people that would say to me, I wish I could do that, or I wish that I could learn how to do that, or I could do what you're doing. And I tell them, well, you can. And so for me, the reason for doing it was wanting to see others come together and enjoy each other and enjoy the love of sport, the love of running, the love of any kind of sport, cycling, anything where people are included. Because sometimes for me, if I'm having a difficult time finding a guide, I'll say, well, I'm just not going to do that. And I didn't want others to feel down and feel hopeless. I wanted people to be able to say, oh, so what you're saying is if I join Achilles and you can help me find somebody that will want to run with me and do a marathon. Or it might just be that one person that says, I really don't want a marathon, Lupita. I just want to go for some walks and go other places or meet other people. Then Achilles is still the place for you. Or for me, right, walking on a treadmill is great. But going out and getting the fresh air and the smells and talking to somebody as I'm running just makes the time go by so much faster. And it makes the sport so much more fun. I always have somebody by my side, and I like that. That's teamwork.
You know, for me, running is also a really social sport. And so just hearing her talk about all of those details just really kind of solidifies that really special relationship that running has. It's like, oh yeah, that's what it's like.
Yeah. So I had these conversations before you had the interview with Julianne, and they really resonated with me because I got the sense from everybody that I spoke with that these relationships within their groups were so meaningful and authentic. And in fact, I started thinking about all this because I had heard this woman on this other podcast promoting a book she had written about overcoming loneliness and making friends as an adult. And she was talking about how difficult it can be to make good friends. And it struck me that the folks at Achilles had really found something that a lot of people are looking for. And even when Lupita mentioned the volunteer she met in Las Vegas, it sounded like he signed up to volunteer thinking he was doing a good deed. But before long, he realized he wasn't just doing community service. He was making these authentic relationships that improved his own life. And then all the other athletes that I spoke to, without knowing what the others had said, they all described Achilles as a big family, not just a group of people that they run with. Like Julianne mentioned, a marker of a satisfying relationship is one in which you have social support. You know you can count on somebody when you need help or when you need a favor. And for an athlete like Lupita, if she's going to run outside, she typically is going to need a guide to join her. And when somebody shows up to run with her, that's confirmation that this is someone she can count on. And I imagine that builds a meaningful bond between people. So I also spoke with Amy Saffel, who is a wheelchair racer in Nashville, Tennessee. We talked a lot about how important it is for folks who use wheelchairs or different accommodations to not be separated from those who don't, whether that's in sports or in life. And a lot of that, we were talking about the Americans with Disabilities Act and some of the differences that that makes. So that's something you can read about on the journal if you want to hear more about that conversation. But anyway, Amy had a very different experience growing up than Lupita did. So Lupita was really excluded from sports, but Amy had access to tons of adaptive sports opportunities when she was growing up in Atlanta. She mentioned seriously like 10 different sports she was active in. This woman does everything.
Hi, my name is Amy Saffel, and I grew up in Roswell, Georgia, just outside of Atlanta. I've lived in Nashville since 2004 and have been part of the Achilles Nashville chapter since it began. So I'm the executive director of Able Youth, and so we help kids with physical disabilities learn to be independent using adaptive sports as a vehicle for them to be able to do that. And so I've been executive director, I think, about 4 years now, and actually worked in the music industry before that. But I love getting to both participate alongside the kids that I work with, and then I see myself in them all the time. I love, you know, thinking back to when I was their age and how far I've come, and then giving them a real world example of, you know, how far that they can come.
So Amy is creating opportunities for disabled athletes to participate in the same events as other runners.
No, I think participating in races, you know, does a lot, because maybe I start first, but I'm not somebody that's going to finish first. And so, like, I'm going to be among people that don't have disabilities, you know, when I'm in the middle of races, and definitely when I'm training. When we're in Achilles, you know, we're out there on the Greenway, we're among everybody else. And then I go to another running group on a different night, and I'm the only person in a chair. And so, you know, and a lot of times in a race, I'm either the only person in a chair, maybe there's one or two other people. And so I think that automatically dispels a lot of the misconceptions that people with disabilities, you know, aren't capable physically, or, you know, don't get out and sit home and whatever. And so I think just the participation in sports, and specifically in races, really helps to dispel that, because people, lots of people, get to see me as a capable person. And so I think that's one of the great things about running too, is that I'm enjoying it and I'm getting the health benefits, but then also I feel like whether or not I know it or recognize it, like, I'm helping to change society little by little, hopefully, you know.
So if you take anything away from our conversations today, take away this idea of gratitude and community, and we're all going to be stronger and healthier and happier if we do all this together. I think Achilles International and Mike and Julianne's research all provide excellent examples of this. Thanks for listening. Thanks for sharing it with your friends. Have a great run.
We're grateful for you.
Bye-bye!